maybe it wouldn't be too bad to take a class period and look at a couple of key terms and switch the lecture schedule around. So I'm going to do a kind of guided dialogue today. And in order for it to work well, I'll be asking you questions. You have to project when you speak. Otherwise, I have to constantly repeat everything. I'll repeat a little bit of what you say, but project your voice loud enough so everyone can hear. And also, as we go back and forth, it's important, I think, not to censor yourself too much. These kinds of guided dialogues work best when you don't try to think too long and then the moment passes. It really is interesting to know what you're thinking at the moment. So don't be hesitant to speak out. We're trying to gain understanding of terms and see what we can learn. The first term I'd like you to think about is that term, value. Just what is the term? Greg is going to be our scribe here. What does this term call to mind when you hear the term value? Just anyone, jump in. Worth, okay. Others, what does it call to mind? What you hold dear. Beliefs. Value. A little free association. What does the term suggest to you? Yes. Morals. Mm-hmm. Way in back. Scarcity. Must be an economist in our midst here. Okay. Value. What does that term? Yes. Religion. Okay. Term value. Other things that may call to mind. Okay, that's a start. Yes?
Priorities.
Good. Question two. Can you know whether particular value claims are true or not? Can you know whether they're correct or not, true or false, or whether they're right or wrong? How many of you think you can? Not many takers, half a dozen. How many of you think you can't? Okay, stronger on the no side and a fair number of non-committed. Okay, let's talk about that. Those of you who... there were more of those of you who thought you can't know whether value claims are true or not. Why do you think that? Yes? Depends on... We've got a budding philosopher. Thank you. True. Okay. Depends on your definition of true. Others, without too much censorship. Why can't you know whether a value claim is true or not? Yes. Depends on your culture. Others? Okay, how you're enculturated, how you're raised. Good. Others, why can't you know whether a value claim is true or not? Mm-hmm. Okay, you can know for yourself, but not necessarily make the judgment for someone else. Others? Who's to say whether it's right or wrong? Mm-hmm. Yes? No proof? Okay. Okay. Let me test you out on a particular value claim. How many of you know the following statement is true? It is wrong for any human being to torture any other human being just for the hell of it, just for no particular reason at all. Now, I add the qualification because you could conceive of a situation where a terrorist had put a hydrogen bomb in downtown Dallas or New York or Paris, and you resort to torture because you only have 6 hours before it goes off. You resort to torture to find it and save 10 million people. The utilitarians would argue strongly that way. So, but I put a caveat in. How many of you know the following statement is true? It is wrong for any human being, not just for yourself, it's wrong for any human being to torture any other human being just for the fun of it or no particular reason at all. How many of you know that's true? Aha! Somewhat of a shift. How many of you don't know that's true? Few holdouts. Any thoughts on that? Those of you who do or don't know it's true? Yes, and then back there.
Mm-hmm. What I've been thinking about value lately is that values have evolved in humans in order to allow us to survive to the best of our abilities. So
they have survival value. Okay. Yes? You don't know it's true. Okay. Mm-hmm. Others? Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it go back to the idea that if you value torturing people, then it's true for you?
Okay. If you value torturing people, it's true for you. That's interesting. Yes? Are we assuming a rational person? Not someone who's mentally ill. And you commented, there's no such thing as a rational or completely rational person. An irrational person might, okay. Any other thoughts on this? Yes? Okay, for your religion or your culture. Or let me try another difficult statement. How many of you know that what Hitler did to Jews and the Romana, the Gypsies, and gays and dissident Christians and Eastern Europeans, how many of you know that what he did was wrong? Huh, it's changing a little. How many of you don't know that? A few holdouts here. Okay. Let's leave this just for a moment and ask, what does this term, fact, what does that mean? Let's have a little free association around that term. What do we mean? Yes? Okay, something proven to be true, yes? Something you witness, agreed upon by everybody, supported by evidence, something never proven false. I'm doing some of the repetition for the tape, good. Okay, others, fact. Can you know whether facts are true or not? How many of you think you can? How many of you think you can't? Interesting. Let's talk about that a little bit. Yes?
When you say the word fact, it kind of brings up this fuzzy line between what we perceive as fact and what really truly exists.
Okay.
Really base our ideas on our own perceptions.
Your perceptions, you're implying, might be false at times or misleading. Okay. Others? Yes?
Well, it used to be fact that the world's flat, and it's
not so. Now it's not? Okay. Yes? Okay, you can be in a big trouble if you don't accept some things as true. Yes? Okay. Yes?
I think
Okay. Let's complicate this a little bit. How many of you know that this claim is true? E equals mc squared. How many of you know that's true? Two, three, four. You don't take physics courses anymore? Or? Steve, not even you know it's true? Boy, we're in trouble. Okay. How many of you know that the mass of the sun is at least twice that of the earth? How many of you know that is true? How many of you don't know that's true? Boy, no. And you can't believe what taxes I'm paying for education, and we get this kind of result. How do we complain about this, Greg? And the tuition you're paying at Cornell. You really don't know that's true? How many? Yes? Okay, yes?
Yes, but at the same time, I mean, we're talking about things which have been formulated, have been calculated, and it just, if it is a leap of faith, that's fine. But otherwise, I'll say, maybe that story thing is only I'm seeing it, so I can't move, so I know I'm comfortable to say we're here, I don't know if anything around me is truly real, so I can't go anywhere else.
Okay, well, let's take a simpler one. I don't know, maybe it's not simpler. How many of you know that water has has two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom? How many of you know that's true? Okay, and how many of you don't know that's true? Thank you. Wonderful. Let's take methane, CH4. How many of you know that methane has one carbon and four hydrogen? How many of you don't know that? Okay. Yes?
We've been taught that methane is CH4. But none of us can see it. And we've been taught that it's not good to torture somebody. But, it's a value. Do we believe that methane is CH4? Do we believe it's not good to torture somebody?
Okay, let's ask another question. What does this term mean? To know. What does it mean to know something? Again, let's just have some uncensored responses. Yes, in front.
I think that there's a few kinds of knowledge. There's one kind of knowledge that you've been talking about, what we're taught, and then there's another kind of knowledge that you feel from your heart, and that's a very different sort of knowledge.
Okay, different kinds of knowledge. Yes? No doubt? You're certain of it? Or okay. Yes? Okay. Okay. Thank you. Yes?
To have information about it?
Okay. Others, what does it mean to know something? Oh, this thing just fell off of my mic. To know something, what does that mean? Other comments? Yes?
I know because I've been there, and I think you want to go to a place.
You've been there yourself. You've experienced it.
Yeah.
Okay. Knowledge gives control over things. Okay. Jamie, I'm not letting you in as a TA. You've got a sorry. The TAs are exempt from this. Any other thoughts? Yes?
An understanding.
Okay, yes? you believe to be true. How many of you know that if I stand on this chair, it'll support me? How many of you don't know that? Okay, Steve, I'm going to show you're wrong. It supported me. The gods were angry, though. Okay.
Now we know because he demonstrated it to us.
Well, are you certain I can do it again?
Yeah.
Really? That chair may have been on its last leg, so to speak. What? Not certain? Okay. Is knowledge the same as certainty? How many of you think it is? How many of you think it isn't? Okay. Let me ask you another question, or put it in a... How many of you think that I am theoretically certain right now that I'm awake? You may have already wondered. How many of you think I'm theoretically certain of that? How many of you think... Okay, how many of you think I'm not? Okay, I'm not theoretically certain that I'm awake. I can remember in the early 1930s when I was a kid, I would get infections. This was before antibiotics and penicillin and sulfa even. And you'd get a high fever and you'd start hallucinating. And the whole, everything would shift around. You didn't know whether you were awake or asleep or hallucinating or what. Scary, especially for a little kid. And I've talked with people who've taken LSD and peyote and other mind-expanding or shrinking drugs. And they tell me also they don't know then anymore for sure quite what's going on, whether they're awake or hallucinating or sleeping or what. So I would say right now that I'm not theoretically certain I'm awake. Do I know I'm awake? Of course. I don't have a shadow of a doubt right now that I'm awake. And what I would suggest is one of the most fateful decisions that happened or moves in Western philosophy was the equation of knowledge with theoretical certainty. And I want to just take a little bit of time to unpack that and then come back with more responses and more questions. Descartes, René Descartes, the French philosopher and mathematician. Bob, what are the dates for Descartes? Late 1500s, I think. I always lose on that one. He went through a famous thought experiment that most of you have probably heard of. He said, I want to systematically doubt everything that I can doubt, so that after the acids of doubt have done their work, that I might have possibly a sure foundation on which to build my theory of knowledge, my philosophical structure. So he doubted, and he doubted, and he doubted. And then one day he had this eureka experience, this enlightenment experience, cogito ergo sum. We're not... I think, therefore, I am. He may have done his doubting in French. What would it be? Je pense, donc je suis. I think, therefore, I am. We're not sure. And he said, now, this I really can't doubt. This seems so totally certain to me that because I'm thinking, I must exist, that this will form a bedrock for all my subsequent theories about knowledge and reality and so on. And that seemed like a very, very convincing, helpful move to make. But it was not long before critics began to challenge Mr. Descartes and say, wait a minute, you didn't really fulfill your end of the bargain. You didn't doubt radically, because had you doubted radically, you would have had to doubt the grammatical, the syntactical validity of the French and Latin in which you did your doubting, and you would have been totally paralyzed. Just let me give you another kind of example. A little child holds up a coffee mug for you, and she's just learning to speak, and she has a question in her eyes and wants to know the name of it. And you say, you give a nice big smile and say, oh, a giraffe. And then she, it's a sort of complicated word, and so the next day she comes back and you say, oh, an alligator or an airplane or whatever. And then maybe the third day, just for variety, you say, oh, a coffee mug. What's going to happen to that kid? She's never going to learn to speak, and she's never going to learn to think as a human being, because human thinking is intrinsically dependent, inevitably, inherently dependent on language usage. The few cases we have of kids raised in the wild have hardly been recognizably human in anything but a physical sense, because humanity and language are very, very closely connected together. What philosophers have come to believe is that Descartes' experiment got us off on the wrong track, because knowledge very, very rarely is theoretical certainty. Knowledge is much sooner what we might refer to as justifiable belief, or warrantable assertion, or a claim for which you can give good reasons. It rarely is theoretical certainty. When I got up this morning, I was just about ready to eat my oatmeal. Actually, I don't eat oatmeal, but let's assume that. And I suddenly asked myself, wow, am I certain it's safe? And then, no, I'm not. I remember there was a student last spring that I flunked in one of my classes. And I remember that I saw him yesterday walking up and down Klein Road with sort of a glassy look in his eyes. And I remember I left the back door unlocked. Ah, I'm not certain. He may be out to get me. So I don't eat the oatmeal. By that time, I'm ready to leave for work, and I'm just ready to turn the key in the car. And I say, oh, it wasn't the oatmeal. It's a bomb under the hood. And then I say, okay, I could use a little exercise. I walk to work, and I'm just about ready to turn the key in the door. Nope, that's what's booby-trapped. You are certain of very, very little, but you have a justifiable belief in most cases that those things didn't happen. You spoke of probability, and there is an element of probability in almost all knowledge claims. Aristotle distinguishes between practical reason and theoretical reason. And in terms of practical reason, we know a great deal. We trust elevators and airplanes. We know that indeed the Earth is not flat, and we know that the mass of the sun is greater than that of the Earth. So that if you think of knowledge as justifiable belief, it becomes possible to know a great deal. Now, I want to come back to that in a moment, but I want to also say something about the absolute necessity of not beginning with radical doubt. Had I insisted on, and a couple of you brought this out, actually, almost word for word with what I'm going to say. Had I insisted on certainty, or had I insisted on beginning with radical doubt, I would have been paralyzed. I wouldn't have eaten. I wouldn't have gotten to school. I wouldn't have dared go in my office. I wouldn't have dared walk through this the door. I would have mistrusted all of you. One of you looks a little like the Columbine kid, you know, or whatever. So I was not theoretically certain of any of that. And had I insisted on an epistemology, a philosophical view of knowledge that says knowledge is certainty, I would have been paralyzed. All human flourishing begins with assent or belief. One or two of you said that too. Begins with assent or belief or acceptance of certain truths. You cannot survive with radical doubt. Wayne Booth, former English professor and dean at the University of Chicago, in his book Modern Dogma and the Rhetoric of Assent, uses many illustrations, but one that I remember, your spouse wakens you in the middle of the night, and he says, "Oh, I'm deathly ill. I'm just in awful shape." And indeed, he looks sort of green and pale and shaking, and you know that he's not a practical jokester. He's never pulled any crazy tricks on you before in connection with this sort of thing. And now Booth asks the question, how many of you know that you ought to get help for your spouse? Well, we all know that. Why pretend you don't know what you know? You have very good reasons for getting help for your spouse in that case. And if you don't act on those reasons, the results are terrible. Now, let's come back now to the tension between factual claims and moral claims. We know of no society anywhere at any time in human history that has permitted gratuitous harm doing to other members of that little group. And then over the millennia, this protected group has spread out, so that today many people think that we ought not to do gratuitous harm to any human being. Nowhere ever have we found a society that permits you willy-nilly to torture and harm other people. And I think the results of the reasons for that are fairly clear. If such a society had existed, they probably would not have survived, and we would have had no information about them. Even wolf packs and other animals that hunt in packs and so on, they do not inflict gratuitous harm on each other. They wouldn't function. They wouldn't survive if they did. We know of no society anywhere at any time that has permitted willy-nilly lying. There may be differences in what a lie, how they view lying. If your Aunt Mabel asks you, "Isn't this just the most beautiful hat you've ever seen?" and you think it's just atrocious, you may sort of fudge it a little bit, because after all, you have to live with her. White lies, it's not clear you should, but at least you might think in that direction. Or like the minister, the new mother asked him of a baby that looked very ordinary, in fact, somewhat less than ordinary, and she asked, "Now, don't you think this is just the most beautiful baby you've ever seen?" And the minister smiles and says, "Now that really is a baby." You try to get out of it. But you can't survive with willy-nilly lying. And in both of these cases, there are incredibly good reasons for holding those moral beliefs. I could give you a half a dozen others. Generally, except where somebody has a mental break, mothers don't abuse and torture their children, and on and on. Now, does it not then make sense to say, I know that claim is true? If knowledge is justifiable belief, if it is warrantable assertion, if it is a claim for which you can give good reasons, why doesn't it make sense to say, I know it's wrong for any human being to torture any other human being? Is it possible theoretically that you might be wrong? Yes, there's a very, very, very remote possibility you're wrong. But that's true of everything. That's true of every scientific claim we make. There's also a remote possibility you're wrong. Notice how odd it would sound. It doesn't sound odd to most of you if someone says, "Oh, that's just your value judgment." But notice how odd it would sound if someone said, "Oh, that's just your chemistry judgment," or "That's just your physics or your ecological judgment." What do you mean? But it really doesn't necessarily make any more sense in terms of value claims or moral claims. Now, does that mean that all moral claims are obviously true or and so on? Of course not. There are a lot of moral claims that we reject out of hand. Anyone who thought Hitler was acting morally, most of us would reject that out of hand. But why hesitate to say, I know that was wrong, if you have a view of knowledge that does not entail theoretical certainty? If you use roughly the same view of knowledge that you use in chemistry and physics. Now, there is a crucial difference. In human affairs, we can't generally, for instance, take 100 kids and beat the hell out of them for 10 years and abuse them in every way, and then another 100 and treat them with tender, loving care and compare the results. It's just too costly, and almost all of us reject it out of hand. So in human affairs, we often do thought experiments. To a considerable degree, drama, literature, to some degree, other forms of art and so on, are thought experiments. Dostoevsky writes The Brothers Karamazov or The Idiot, or think of other novels that you like. I just watched a long BBC film of War and Peace with Anthony Hopkins. Nice production of it. In a way, what these authors are doing, I'm not sure it's always a self-conscious doing. In some ways, the characters take on a life of their own. Or perhaps a more obvious example would be Pride and Prejudice or novels like that. They're asking what might happen if we lived this way. What might be the results in, say, an Anna Karenina and so on? Because we're not willing to actually have controlled experiments. Now, another way we learn in human affairs is we learn through our mistakes, and that's why accurate historical writing is valuable. We're just getting near what I hope might be the tail end of a disastrous social experiment. For 30 years now or more, psychologists and human development people at places like Cornell have said it doesn't make any difference how the family is shaped. You can have two parents, single mother, single father, all kinds of combinations. Doesn't make any real difference for the kids. The problem is that's just totally false. The social science data now is coming in, and it's showing that kids who grow up in broken homes, or kids who grow up where the father got the woman pregnant and then disappeared, never showed up, those kids are hugely disadvantaged on average. I went through an unexpected, unwanted divorce about 30 years ago. My kids were only 3 and 5 years old. I put a Herculean amount of effort into continuing to relate to them. It was almost impossible back then for a man to get custody. And they're doing fairly well, but let me tell you, there are some sleeper effects that aren't nice. Now, this has been a social experiment where we've tried it, and now the trouble is people invested so much in these theories that they're not willing to admit they're wrong. But the data is awful. The effect on kids' lives is simply terrible on average. You're dealing statistically, not talking about individuals. So there are various ways we learn in the realm of morality, ethical claims, and so on, but some of them are extremely costly. Yes?
Are you saying these kids are more deprived or whatever because their parents split up?
Yes.
Or are you saying that just strictly because of the fact that...
Because they didn't hold the family...
Because, like, society holds that as such a high... Because you're saying that will deprive them, these kids are becoming deprived. Because you're
no. I think I don't have the time to give all the evidence, and I'm not an expert on that question. Society has actually become very accepting of divorce in most cases today. There's not a huge stigma. But the The data on the kids is awful. What the best social psychologists say is that unless the parents are just absolutely killing each other, unless it's just mayhem, even if they're unhappy, even quite unhappy, it's almost always better for kids that they stay together, at least until the kids are reasonably well grown. And the data is just hugely clear, and it's largely suppressed at Cornell because it doesn't fit liberal theory. But it's there. And so, yes?
In these social experiments, isn't it difficult to separate out what's really going on and what the effects really are?
It's incredibly difficult. It's terrifically difficult. For 100 years, psychometricians have been thinking about the relation between poverty and IQ and social economic status and things like that. I just finished a section in a book that deals with, it separates out white people and just deals with white poverty and IQ. These relations are incredibly well documented in some cases in social science research. Look at David Blankenhorn's book, Fatherless America, for data on divorce. Yeah, they may be wrong. In fact, they often are. And then usually subsequent research will refine this. So none of these are certain claims. I don't want to get stuck on this because it's not quite where we're going, but I'll throw it out because that I think is the way we often learn in terms of social phenomena. Now, let me come back then and then get a few reactions from you. Does this move make sense to you? We can come back to some of these other questions in other contexts. Does it make sense to you that we have to start with assent rather than doubt? And does it make sense that one of the implications of redefining knowledge is that the radical split between facts and values would lessen? Now, facts and values are not the same. They are different in some ways, but even in the natural sciences, not just in morality, but also in the natural sciences, you start with certain assumptions. One of the assumptions that most scientists work with is that solipsism is false, that there really is a world out there. Solipsism is the belief that only I exist and all of you are projections of my mind. Solipsism, incidentally, is almost impossible to disprove in a tight way. Just like it's almost impossible to disprove the claim that God created the world 5 minutes ago. Because it's theoretically conceivable that he could have done that, or she could have done that, and built into us all these memories and all the aging and Martha Van Rensselaer Hall and the radioactive decay and Martha Van Rensselaer, the concrete is crumbling, they say, and they fear it might collapse. And so on. You can't disprove that. But what do we do with claims of that sort? We just walk away from them. They seem so silly. It contradicts almost all of our experience, and what kind of a god, for instance, would do such a silly thing? Why would one want to be a solipsist? So natural scientists reject solipsism. They assume the regularity and homogeneity of law throughout the universe, that fundamental physical laws don't arbitrarily shift every million years. They assume that it is a universe. Very difficult to prove that, because as we'll look at later, we'll spend a whole lecture on this, the term universe or cosmos is not an empirical term at all, it's a philosophical construct. Scientists assume, as all serious, rational people assume, the law of non-contradiction. Something can't be both A and non-A, same time, manner, and place. So in both morality and in science, you make certain initial assumptions. Any thoughts on any of this? Have I at least made you a little more skeptical of your own skepticism regarding moral claims. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Go with our morals and get back law so that you don't have to come against using it. We don't make the claim that the moral statement, but it's a judicial statement.
And we do distinguish between legal claims and moral claims. And in extreme cases, people argue that some laws are so fundamentally misguided that the only moral response is to disobey the law. But again, that's a big decision. Yes, we do make those distinctions. Does it begin to make sense to you that you could give good reasons for moral claims, or you could even say, I know that that claim is true? Does this begin to make sense to you? Think for a... Yes? Mm-hmm.
I don't know, you can go one way or you can go another way, but it feels like if you try and push it in a direction too far, you just, like, drop off into some sort of, like, weird abyss of just, like, I mean, there's people that believe in God, there's people that don't believe in God, there's people that believe that, I don't know, Hitler believed that he needed to start up this thing. There's all sorts of people now that believe that that was totally messed up. I mean...
Well, I think what you're pointing to, and helpfully so, would be related to the point I made that I would claim to be theoretically certain about very little. I'm practically certain. I have a high degree of confidence in all kinds of claims. So, again, get away from the idea that knowledge is theoretical certainty. The point is that unless you... believe certain things because you believe there are good reasons for believing them, you are paralyzed. You're finished. You'll die. Just as simple as that. And what has happened is this split between value claims and fact claims is a very recent phenomenon. In fact, the term value used as we do today is a very recent phenomenon and a very odd phenomenon in some ways. Almost all classical thinkers... would not buy into the fact-value split in the way many people do today. And what I'm suggesting is that you've been taught badly, because for the last 30 or 40 years, this kind of moral relativism or value subjectivism has just become endemic in our school systems and so on. I would argue that it doesn't even make sense to be a total... relativist in things like aesthetics and so on. You may seriously debate whether Beethoven is a better musician than Bach or vice versa, but you don't know anything if you think that Bear is a better musician than either of them. I mean, you don't know anything at all, and I have great confidence in the judgment that they're both better musicians than me. So even in the realm of aesthetics... or even in, if you take a somewhat more difficult area, like wine connoisseurship, it's not totally subjective at all. Certain wines leave an awful cloying, have a cloying taste and have a bad aftertaste or have a bad aroma that makes it not pleasant to drink. Those are not altogether subjective. One of the best examples, I won't do it, but if I took my thumbnail and scratched it across the board, there would be almost universal dislike of that. Just like there's almost universal dislike of little tiny infants of very low voices. And mothers and fathers, too, all instinctively pretty much raise their voices when they're talking with little kids because it's more pleasing to them. Better, no. Well, let me tell you where I would come at it. I believe, And this comes out of my Christian belief that all of us are created in the image of God and of equal value. If you're talking about physical strength, of course some are weaker and some stronger. If you're talking about IQ, there are very significant differences. If you're talking about sickle cell anemia, some of you have some genes possibly that'll protect you from other things. There are all kinds of differences.
Well, I'm not necessarily speaking in terms of strength or anything like that. When you look at someone and you're talking to them, I like this person, I don't like this person.
Sure.
And basically what that's saying is this person is better than this person, isn't it?
No. I believe that I am commanded to act justly and to love everyone. But I am not commanded to like everyone because I don't have control over my likes and dislikes, basically. Those are emotional responses below the level of conscious thought. But I can make a decision to treat you all justly. If I end up just arbitrarily assigning Fs and Ds and Cs, Bs and As on a lottery basis at the end of this course, you're going to not feel very good about that. But I may not end up liking all of you. You may not like me. Doesn't matter all that much. I will try my best to be open to you, to respect you, to be fair to you, to give you equal treatment in terms of encouragement. There's a great temptation among faculty, and I have to resist this, that a few of your students are unusually bright, and there's a great temptation to want to spend most of your time with them because it's so much fun. And I try to resist that. Because it doesn't seem to me a just way to teach. Sometimes on my own time, I'll agree with an exceptionally bright student who's really, really interested in some of the stuff to do an extra independent study. But in terms of any classroom involvement, my obligation is to treat all of you fairly, to respect all of you, and so on. But I may not end up liking all of you. Does that make sense? Okay.
You're making all these.
Okay. Any last thoughts? Yes.
If you can say that something is, justifiably believable, can you then make the assumption that everyone else will also reasonably find that same thing to be justifiably?
Yes and no, with great limitations. If you come to my home and I'm a smoker and I have some books of matches on the coffee table and you take one home with you, fine. We don't think of that as stealing. If you're on a hunting trip with Inuit, middle of the winter, and you take the last book of matches or lighter with you, you condemn them to death. Similar situations, very, very different results. We almost always have attenuating factors, and thus we look at the total context, the total situation. Doesn't mean there are no regularities across cultures and so on. There's huge regularities in the field of morality. We look at the differences because they're more startling in a way. But as C.S. Lewis and others have argued, if you look cross-culturally, a great proportion of morality is simply more or less assumed everywhere. Generally, people don't beat up on and torture their kids and starve their children and so on and so on. But yeah, situations differ very substantially, and we have to take that into account. Now, there are also extremely difficult issues. We're in the middle now of talking about our cultures, issues like euthanasia and abortion, and they're tough issues. I am not totally settled on the issue of abortion, but I do know that my mind is settled on partial birth abortion, to take a kid just ready to be born, to turn him around so the head comes out last, to puncture the skull and suck the brains out. I think is a barbaric thing to do, and the law ought to forbid that, as most civilized countries do. On the other hand, there's a lot more debate about and a lot more disagreement about first trimester abortion. Euthanasia, these are tough issues. So I'm not at all suggesting that all moral issues are simple and straightforward, and we agree. We've had a 2.5-century debate in America, and we're not done yet, about relations between the races. In the early 1700s, Quaker John Woolman went up and down the colonies arguing to his fellow Quakers that our treatment of animals, Native Americans, and our treatment of blacks were wrong. He finally convinced them. It took another 50 years. They convinced the Methodists and Presbyterians and so on. And it still didn't agree. We fought a civil war, and we're still at it. But there's been a huge shift over that 250 years and a lot of consensus today. I don't think one of you would want publicly to defend slavery today or certain forms of racial discrimination and so on. We've reached a very solid consensus on those issues. These I see our time is up. We'll see as the semester goes on that some issues are rather more easy and some are very, very difficult. Thank you.